Well, good morning. Perhaps we could start on what promises to be a rather busy day, and we mustn't fall behind so early in the day. Let me introduce myself first. My name is Dennis Galligan. I'm Professor of Sociolegal Studies in Oxford University and Director of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. It's a great pleasure to be here in University of Virginia Law School, my first time in this part of the world, full of historical interest and significance, and so it seems quite a suitable place in which to be talking about the social foundations of constitutions. So before starting on the substantive, there are just a couple of things. I'd like to say a word about the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is an independent, I suppose a kind of think tank, independent but affiliated with the University of Oxford, and for the last 5 or 6 years has been engaged in a number of programs of discussion, workshops, publications, not so much a research institute, but more interested in making research available to a wider audience, particularly an audience of practicing lawyers, businessmen, government officials, international bodies, you name it. So the idea behind the foundation, in a way, is that there's a lot of interesting research being done in law and the social sciences under the general notion of the role of law in society, and yet a lot of that research never goes beyond the rather closed realms of the academic world. So our aim is to make it more available, and this is reflected both in our programs and also in our website, which is very much loaded with interesting things on China and the social contract revisited, law and society in China, social contract, the courts and public policy, and this program, the Social and Political Foundations of Constitutions, which has now been running for a couple of years. And I'd like to very much thank my colleague, Miele Versteeg, one of our, I have two former doctoral students here, Miele and Justin Cohen, who are, I wish all students were quite up to their standards, but sadly, life's not quite so straightforward. And they did set a pretty impossibly high standard. However, it's such a nice thing to work with Miele, who's been a great pleasure to work with. And now that she's based here in this law school, it also widens our base, widens our ability to perhaps reach out to more of the American audience as well as the European audience. Justin is studying law now, and after doing a doctorate on European Union issues, and so I hope Justin will become more involved as well. I'd like also just to thank the University of Virginia Law School for its support as a joint sponsor of the occasion, and again, this is a very lovely and suitable room for our discussions. All right, that's enough for me. I'm going to hand over to Miele now for a few general comments.
Thank you. Well, first I wanted to welcome everybody to Charlottesville, at least our international guests or people from other parts of the country. Dennis and I have hosted a number of these events where we try to study the social and political foundations of constitutions, or what really drives constitution making. This is the first time we do it in Charlottesville. And also, this event, I guess, is a little different from our previous events, because usually our approach is that we ask people to write specifically on a certain country, for example, and study what happened in that particular place. Whereas here, I mean, the Arab Spring is a major unfolding event, and it's all happening very fast. So we basically invited people, the main people who are working on these issues, to come together and present whatever they're working on. And our idea would be, if everybody is in this room together talking about this, then maybe we get some sense of what sort of the overarching themes and issues are in the writing of the constitutions, the current constitution writing in the Middle East. And some things we thought would come up, and I think will come up today, is, I mean, how do we deal with Islam? So what place does Islam get in the constitution? What happens if it conflicts with liberal principles or rights, or will it? As Clark will probably talk about that. Will we get moved to some sort of constitutional theocracy, where maybe constitutional courts will impose liberal limits on Islam, or maybe not? How do we protect women's rights, as Karima's paper is, we're going to talk about that. What does it mean that these constitutions are written in a moment of revolution and a time of major social upheaval, right? And this is not just true for the constitutions that are being written right now, but that's been true for many constitutions, for example, also the ones that were written in the 1990s in Eastern Europe, or many constitutions in Western history. So, I mean, how are people going to deal with the desire to, at the one hand, break away from the past, while at the same time trying to preserve some of their identity? It's something, a theme that comes up in Nathan's paper, that people are looking back to an earlier period of time, which is something that that seems to be a theme. What does it mean that the previous constitutions were only partially delivered, or perhaps sham? But maybe I'm not allowed to use that word. How are these constitutions going to accommodate different ethnic and linguistic groups within the country? How will this affect the document? Will it opt maybe for a minority rights regime, or is it going to be the danger of all sorts of secessions, as Chibli talks about? So I think that's also a theme. What will be the role of the military? And finally, maybe why are we seeing a move towards constitutionalism in the first place? Why are people so eager to write constitutions, even if their previous experience with constitutions may not have been very good? So, and I think some people here in the audience will be here with an interest in constitutions. Others will be here with an interest in the Arab Spring. And I think, I hope we'll be able to talk about both.
Well, thank you very much, Mila, for that. And so I think probably, although we're 1 or 2 minutes in advance, we might as well start the substantive session, unless anybody's got any questions they want to raise about that. Well, it falls to me to be the happy rapporteur for the first paper. Now, I have to, academics usually enter a caveat before they say anything, and so I'm going to follow in that noble tradition and saying that I'm anything but an expert in Egypt or Tunisia or any other parts of the Arab Spring world. I come really as an outsider looking in. My sources of information are essentially the Financial Times, The Economist, and 1 or 2 other reputable journals. But I'm interested in constitutions and how they come about, and as I'll show in the course of my comments, I'm particularly interested in the concept of the people in constitutions. So with that caveat, I'll now proceed to present and comment on Nathan's paper. A very stimulating, shortish, but stimulating and I think challenging paper. And the first thing that strikes me about it is there's a lot behind the scenes. There's a lot of research, almost a lifetime's research and understanding and thinking about these issues behind Nathan's paper. And so it draws, I think, implicitly on a very rich background. It seems to me that essentially the paper asks 2 questions. Why the uprising in Tunisia and Egypt take constitutional form, number one? And secondly, can the revolutionary impulse to constitutionalize political authority succeed? I think, in fact, there are other questions in the course of the paper which I'll bring out, but they seem to be the 2 main questions Nathan wants to raise here. His interest is in the constitutions of authoritarian nations and how they, in a way, constitutionalize authoritarianism. Quite an interesting issue. Constitutions and authoritarian politics interact with each other. In passing, the author questions the notion of constitutions being mere facades in authoritarian regimes. And by facade is probably meant something similar to sham, a notion that Mila and David Law examined recently, and it must be said came to rather different conclusions. So there's one issue we might pick up later on. Can we talk about sham constitutions in this context? Let me turn to authoritarian constitutionalism, a bit of a mouthful. Nathan argues that the seeming secret of the Egyptian and Tunisian constitutional orders was the way they laid out structures of political authority, and they even more carefully made sure that all chains of command ran ultimately back to the presidency. Quote, yet both constitutions introduced constitutional discourse, constitutional structures, constitutional ideas. They were manipulated and exploited to suit the ruling regimes. But at the same time, they created a context in which constitutionalism was part of the way of thinking and acting. Once such a mode of thought and action takes root, it can be hard to remove. The author goes on to argue that the constitution of authoritarian nations, when examined closely, when the fine print is studied, are not facades or shams, but quite plain in constitutionalizing authoritarianism. Now, I think this could be understood in two ways, which perhaps need a little clarification. First, it could mean that even a constitution entrenching an authoritarian system is likely to contain some elements of constitutionalism, as understood in the Western tradition of constitutional thought. That is to say, the very fact of conducting government within a publicly stated set of standards, following given procedures and working through settled institutions, introduces, by its nature, an element of constitutionalism. And it does so even if the result is an authoritarian system. The very act of governing through a constitution may be a kind of restraint on government. That's one interpretation, I think, of this relationship between constitutions and authoritarianism. A second is this. The second meaning would be that such constitutions are likely to contain values and ideas, or at least elements of them, of the kind we find in more standard modern constitutions of democratic nations, namely rights and liberties, limits on government, and accountability of government. It's all a matter of degree, of course, but at least with respect to Egypt, which was authoritarian rather than totalitarian, the paper shows, I think, good evidence of both ideas, although perhaps less so with Tunisia. I think this is an interesting theme that could be tested by close study of the constitutions of other countries, such as those mentioned in the paper, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. So that's one issue that relates to the idea of authoritarian constitutionalism. Nathan in his paper then goes on to a different issue, namely the viability or sustainability of constitutions. And he suggests that there are three factors that sustain the life of constitutions. The first is the cost of reopening constitutional arrangements. They are high. And the benefits to particular parties are unpredictable. Better the dog you know than the dog you don't, that idea. The second factor that he identifies is that groups and interests, which become more powerful than before, may find that the constitutional tools used against them previously are now theirs to use to strengthen their position and to serve their interests. The French presidency is cited as one example. Another is Palestine, where Hamas found a constitution from which it had stood aloof, now served to protect against attempts to overturn the popular vote. And I think Nathan gives some very interesting examples of that idea. The third factor, he says, he identifies for the sustainability of constitutions is, I think, rather different. It seems to be that constitution making can be educative. The main educative function here is that it prepares various parties for the operation of normal politics. Parties get used to sharing with each other, of dealing with each other within a structured environment. Well, having outlined those factors, I think the question is that he poses in his paper, can the revolution succeed? By this is meant, according to Nathan, will the outcome be a liberal democratic constitutional order? Well, my own guess is no, but I'll go on to deal with Nathan's analysis of that. So one answer to this question, will the outcome be of this kind, would be to point to the involvement of various political groups in the constitution-making process. There is a body of opinion that links such involvement to the endurance of constitutions and to their operation in a democratic manner. This, however, although an attractive idea, lacks the backing, in my view, of empirical research and is subject to many variable factors. Another way of looking at the significance of the parties being involved in constitution making is that it accustoms them to normal political activity, another strong theme coming through Nathan's paper. This might be the reason why constitutions endure. Parties simply get used to engaging in activity of this kind. rather than because constitutions represent some transcendent status, some set of values transcending political life. But Nathan's idea that constitutions endure because they sustain and are sustained by political activity of a certain kind. I think that's, again, a very suggestive idea. He then goes on to look at the prospects for success as defined in the two countries in question, and his general view seems to be quite optimistic. He thinks that overall there are signs of promise. First of all, with regard to the first condition, there is agreement on the rules of the game, so that constitutional ideas become embedded in the game. Secondly, he adverts to the likelihood of power rotating amongst the various groups contending for power, so that each group has an interest in maintaining a constitutional structure, because that group might in turn be calling the shots. So it has an opportunity, well, a motive for supporting the constitution even when it's not in a position of control. And then coming to the educative feature, which I think Nathan discusses in a very informative way, he distinguishes fairly sharply between Tunisia here and Egypt, suggesting that perhaps in Tunisia, groups are more willing to engage in compromise, whereas in Egypt, he draws attention to and may wish to say more about the somewhat distorting influence of the military in the process. And I hope I'm representing Nathan accurately. He'll correct me, of course, if I do take liberties with his argument. Well, now, not having expert knowledge of the two countries, as mentioned, I have learnt a great deal from the author, from his perceptive and compressed account. But I want to now just turn to one or two comments which perhaps take us more directly to constitution making. My first comment is this: contrary to one view, there are good reasons why authoritarian regimes take the trouble to have constitutions. Now, the opposing view, I suppose, would be a Hobbesian one, dear old Thomas Hobbes, who always seems to crop up in constitutional discussion. According to Hobbes, a truly powerful ruler has pretty much total control and does not want to be hindered or constrained by a constitution. One has to look very hard in Leviathan, for example, to find any notion of a constitution. Indeed, the view seems to be that there is none, and there is none because none is necessary. We the citizens hand over to the sovereign full power, and the idea of that power being limited was anathema to Hobbes. Well, experience, of course, has proved Hobbes wrong, seems to me. Using, for example, the polity scores assessment of modern nations, there are around 30 to 40 seriously autocratic nations. All, so far as I can see, have constitutions. Why they have them depends on many factors: history, international acceptability, the need for legitimacy, and so on. But the fact is, authoritarian regimes, or the nations of an authoritarian kind, tend to have well-developed constitutions. So this, I think, supports the point that Nathan was making. My second comment is this. This brings, I think, to the question of considerable interest is, does having a constitution, which will normally provide some guidance as to who rules, as to the institutions and processes through which they rule, while at the same time placing some constraints on ruling. I mean, that's really what a constitution does, those three things. Does having such a constitution tend to influence the attitudes of officials and the people, and accordingly fix in place the elements of constitutionalism? I think that's really at the center of a lot of this debate. You know, so what is the relationship between having a constitution and how you rule, even if you're inclined towards authoritarianism? Now, to answer, we would need to enter into the issues of how officials and people behave within rule-governed institutions and arenas, an interesting and challenging subject. But it's not a new subject. There's a wealth of research and scholarship on institutions and those working within them. I think of Douglas North, the economist, who wrote extensively about the importance of institutions in regulating political activity. William Scott, whose book on organizations and institutions I think are fundamental. International lawyers and international relations have also developed a lot of learning, I think, on that relationship between the, if you like, the normative structure and actual behavior. So here, coming back to constitutions, the issue centers around how external standards and structures, which of course are those of a constitution here, enter into and become accepted within existing social and political arenas. How is the competition between the two sets of social norms and social practices, the spontaneous realm, if you like, spontaneous political realm, and the external standards and processes of constitutions, how is that tension, that inherent tension, resolved? At what point do actors come to rely on external standards? Or, in slightly different language, what leads to the assimilation or acceptance of constitutional standards as standards of action in political life? We might see, those of you perhaps more on the sociological side, we might see here a usefulness for Tony Giddens' idea of reflexivity, for what he calls this horrible word structuration, by which he means simply that actors rely on standards to justify their actions, and in doing so reinforce those standards. The other point here, I think, is really how that conflict between different types of standards, the internal and the external, how is that resolved? So this could be, I think, the beginnings of a very interesting set of further studies. But the simple point for our present purposes is we need to know a lot more about how constitutional standards affect behavior, even in autocratic systems. And I think we have some research and literature in other areas on which to draw. Now, my third point is that the distinction needs to be drawn, I think, and perhaps is not drawn quite as explicitly in the paper as might be desirable, but a distinction needs to be drawn, I think, between the making of a constitution and its endurance or sustainability. The two aspects of constitutions are related, but they are also different and raise different issues, and I want to conclude with a few words about making constitutions. Now, since my own research interest, and I warned you that I'd bring this in, since my own research interest is in the notion of the people in constitutions and constitutional thought, one issue is whether they are involved, and if so, how they are involved in constitution making. Now, this begs the question, well, who are the people and what does it mean to talk about the people? That's another quite complex issue, but let's just take some notion of the people. It is surprising how little research there is on this, and I think of Tom Ginsberg as one of the few people who recently has brought together the existing research. And unless I'm misunderstanding Tom, I think he concludes that, in general, we don't know a huge amount empirically about the involvement of the people in constitution making, nor do we know a lot about the effect of having the people involved in constitution making. So the question here is, we need to know more about how constitutions come into being and the role of the people, individuals, social organizations, interest groups representing the people, etc., through consultation, participation, ratification. It's almost poetic, isn't it? My research suggests a few, although incomplete, my own research, which is so far incomplete but ongoing, suggests that overall the people have a pretty minor role in the making of constitutions. I'm currently looking at very closely the constitutions of the 65 nations which, according to the Polity score, are at the top end of the democratic ladder, if you like. And that's what I'm finding. People don't figure too prominently. Now, a second and related issue here is whether the intensity of involvement of the people, the intensity of involvement, and involvement can take various forms and varies greatly in its intensity. So the question is whether that intensity of involvement bears on whether the constitution is effective and enduring. And as I mentioned, Tom might like to say something about that in the discussion. My third point here is this. The usual case is that constitutions are made, or at least drafted, by special assemblies or commissions or councils. How they come to be appointed and whom they represent are related issues. And again, we need to know much more about that. And I suppose we would find a whole range of issues, from such as the good old British Empire bringing together a group of African leaders in London and saying, here we are, here's the Constitution, go back home and sell it. Or I've always been rather interested in the making of the Japanese Constitution, which I must admit some of your predecessors had a certain influence over, although in the name of the people played no role, although after the Constitution was adopted, interestingly, there was a Constitution Popularization Society created, which went around the country selling the Constitution to the people. That seems quite a nice idea. Again, probably General MacArthur had something to do with that. I'll conclude then by just, by this. We could imagine a blueprint for the study of constitution making to be along the following lines, and I'm almost finished. This, my blueprint, would have 8 points, eight sort of guides, triggers, or eight directions. The first would be the trigger. So what sets off the constitution making process? Revolution, other events, social change, ideas. So what's the trigger for constitutional making? Secondly, the aim. What's the aim of constitution making? A new constitution? Overhauling an old one, just patching it up, as many of the countries in Eastern Europe did after 1989, didn't make new constitutions, just patched up the old one. Changed a few things, got rid of the Communist Party, and so on. Or is it to amend, simply to amend, fundamental amendments, as in your own constitution back in the 19th century? Is it to overcome old problems? Is the idea of the constitution backward-looking? So we would need to analyze very closely, what are the aim? What is the aim of constitution making? Thirdly, context. What are the social factors? What are the historical legacies? And Mila mentioned this common phenomenon of looking back to find historical legacies. When I was doing research into the constitution making in post-1989, I remember in Estonia being very impressed by a group of, they looked like college kids to me, drafting the Constitution of Estonia, and they were looking back to a prior to the pre-communist constitution, an institution. They found great strength in being able to do that. And I think in general, if you look at constitution making in Eastern and Central Europe, those which have been relatively successful since 89 tended to be of that kind, either Estonia or the old Austro-Hungarian Empire or something like it. The ones in most trouble were those that had no legacy to look back on. Anyhow, so context. What's the normative structure of that context? What values are at play in the context? My fourth point would be parties. Who's involved? And I've already touched on this. Political parties, civil society organizations, business interests, and even the people. So the whole idea of who's involved in that process raises an enormous number of issues. My fifth guide would be process. What's the process of constitution making? How is it conducted? Who sets the agenda? We know that agenda setting is one of the most important things. How do the parties get into the magic circle? Who gets represented there? And so on. Is there discussion? Is there consultation? Is there participation? Etc. The sixth guide would be content. What's the content of the Constitution? A very distinguished writer on constitutions in Eastern Europe, who's now on the European Court of Human Rights, Andras Schajo, wrote a wonderful book on the basis of the constitutions called Limiting Government. He argued that if you look at constitutions in Europe, at least, they tend to be backward-looking. Yeah, they're mainly concerned with the problems of yesterday, rather than looking forward to the problems of tomorrow. Now, of course, that's an oversimplification. You might look at your own constitution and say, there's certainly an element of looking back, rebelling and all of that, because the British weren't applying their constitution properly. But there's also an element of looking forward, of course, too, in your own constitution. But overall, what is the content in a sense of, are there immediate issues to be solved? Are there great values to be brought in? I mentioned the historical traditions. But also we need to add international expectations now. You can't just draw a constitution as if you live in isolation. There are all sorts of substantive normative restraints out there in the international global world. And that's an interesting thing in itself, and indeed Mila's own research on diffusion of constitutions, I think, touches on that point. My number seven would be, is this meant to be an interim constitution or a final constitution? It's very interesting that this some constitutional changes take this intermediate step of an interim constitution, sometimes little more than a peace agreement, but perhaps goes on to often be more than that, to be a sort of interim constitution while the more final constitution is being contemplated. South Africa was a good example of that. I have two students, in fact, interestingly, who are working now on this issue of the nature of interim constitutions. Are they distinct concepts from constitutions themselves? And the final point, the final guide in this sort of blueprint of constitution would be ratification, coming back to the people. Are constitutions ratified? Generally speaking, they're not. Most constitutions are not ratified by the people, even in the most democratic countries. Few are. And so, again, if we were to try to just set out an overall comprehensive approach, those kinds of factors, and I'm sure there are others, might be helpful. But anyhow, thank you, Nathan, for your stimulating paper. You now have the opportunity of reply. And it must
okay. Speak. All right. Thank you very much. You said I have 15 minutes. I don't intend to take those, I think. But no more than 15. I will aim for far less. I'm very lucky, or I should say everybody here is very lucky, because I certainly recognize my paper in your remarks, and therefore I don't feel compelled to repeat what it was that I thought I said. It sounds like my major points were understood, so that's good news. I don't have to repeat all that. The bad news is you've raised some broad and challenging issues which I would need much more than 15 minutes to think about, much less to talk about, so I can't quite respond to all of them, but you're giving me some very interesting ideas. Sort of pushing this sort of research forward. I guess I would do is restrict my remarks. Sort of, I'm going to talk around your comments rather than directly address them. On three issues: the idea of an authoritarian constitution, the involvement of the people, and the distinction between writing a constitution and a constitution's endurance. First, with authoritarian constitutions, I mean, I think it's interesting that there is, you know, some work on this that generally starts with the same question, and it's a question that I started with myself, and I'm increasingly convinced it's a bad one, and that is, why do authoritarian regimes have constitutions to begin with? The question does make sense for the Arab world in the 19th century, because there were very conscious attempts to have constitutions that were not recognizably democratic. The first Tunisian constitution, for instance, referred to the people, the word used was the flock. That is, you know, with the state being the shepherd. Not very democratic imagery. But what they were interested in doing in the late 19th century was to, I would say, the phrase that Kim Shepley uses is, in this regard, she says, law is the language that the state speaks to itself. Okay, so what they were trying to do was to come up with a set of sort of regularized patterns of doing things that would render political authority less arbitrary, but they were especially interested in the fiscal realm. They were essentially what they saw were rulers who were almost quite literally running the state out of their back pockets in ways that was driving the state into bankruptcy. So it was fiscally motivated and in a sense administratively motivated. The interesting thing about those efforts is they all failed. They didn't produce the kind of fiscally responsible government that was anticipated, and the Egyptian and Tunisian cases, which the Egyptian was the one I know best, essentially ended with foreign occupation, bankruptcy and foreign occupation. But it does make some sense, at least to ask for the 19th century, what is it that they thought they were doing? Why did they think a constitution would give them some answers? And the constitutions that they wrote were very, very skeletal, very, very administrative, very much focused on procedures and especially on fiscal matters. After that, they stopped asking the question. Right? New authoritarian regimes or changes of regimes do not ask Why do we want a constitution? Most of them take a constitution for granted. It's just one of the tools. It's just something that a state has. And so they ask themselves instead, how can we use this in order to restructure ourselves? Or sometimes, how can we use it to communicate new ideological principles to the society as a whole? But very, very few societies that I know of that have ever had a constitution simply abandon the experiment. Say, we don't need one anymore. There are a few cases, actually, of states living without constitutions for a long time. But even some of those, in the Egyptian case, they would have what they would call temporary constitutions. The constitution that was just abrogated in Egypt, the 1971 constitution, was therefore referred to as the permanent constitution. So it turned out to be false. It wasn't permanent, but it lasted for a long time. So there's something about a constitution that is, in a sense, inevitable to most modern states. Second, with regard to the involvement of the people, here what I want to do is sort of make some forward-looking comments and then actually latch into your idea, which you and Myla mentioned as well, about the sort of odd backward-looking feature of this. We are now in a different moment in Arab constitutional history, at least in Egypt and Tunisia, because what those past constitutional efforts were about was, as I said, kind of existing regimes rearranging themselves. That's not true anymore. And so there is a level of popular engagement with the constitutional process in both countries in some remarkable ways. It happens on a level of sort of public political discourse where everybody is speaking a constitutional language, and when people have political demands, they render them in constitutional forms. So constitutional debates are very, very light. This is not, the past constitutional efforts were primarily focus of the political elite and sometimes of a narrow group of officials. No, this is part of daily political discussions. The second element that's interesting is that for the first time, there's not one single actor who can dominate the process. And that, to me, is a remarkable effort, a remarkable thing about this. And in a sense, talking about the people there is a misnomer, because there is no people. There is no people in the singular. There are people in the plural. And that's what Egyptians and Tunisians are discovering. Sometimes to the great shock, Egypt, which Egyptians will often see their societies very homogeneous. In fact, they're deeply divided on questions of relationship between religion and state, on social and economic questions, and so on. And the reason that I am, in a sense, guardedly optimistic about both societies is that they, essentially, if they're going to reconstruct their political systems, you will need to have a consensus among opposing political forces. And that never happened before. So there's popular involvement, but not involvement by the people, but involvement by lots of people. Here, just a quick side comment about the involvement of the military in Egypt. The Tunisians are fortunate in many ways. Number one, they have a process that was designed sensibly. The Egyptians have a process that I can't even say was designed. It's a cockamamie process. I mean, if I were to describe it, it would be hard to describe it in respectful terms. So the Tunisians are lucky for that reason, and they're also lucky in that the electoral results that they had were ones in which it is very clear that people with sharply different ideological orientations will have to come to terms with each other. That's a little bit less the case in Egypt. I'm still optimistic, despite the ugly process they designed, in spite of the role of the military, and in a sense, it is because, and I'll just say this very briefly, I'm happy to elaborate on it if anybody wants to speak more about it, but the military has proved so politically incompetent that I think its grasp over the constitutional process is rapidly eroding. And in a sense, it is the constitution will be increasingly dominated by civilian political forces. So the fact that the Egyptian process was so badly designed is turning out perhaps to serve the country well. Now, let me just a quick comment about the oddly, this sort of backward-looking nature. I've made the claim this is a different constitutional moment for the Arab world and for Egypt and Tunisia. But to me, what is remarkable is, again, what you're saying about the East European experience. What these societies seem to be doing is taking out their old documents and saying, what do we want to change? What went wrong? In Tunisia, they're actually even mimicking the process. to me, this is remarkable, and I can't completely explain it, why it is that a process that seemed to have served the country so badly is now being resurrected in the Tunisian case. We just did this wrong the first time. If we do it over again, you know, we get a second chance to do it right. That's what the Tunisians are doing. The Egyptians are following a new process, but it is clear to me at this stage that the final constitution that comes out of this, perhaps the more permanent Egyptian constitution, that will be ratified this year or next, is one that will resemble the 1971 constitution very, very extensively. Basically tweaking some of its provisions, especially involving a few of its ideological provisions, but especially involving a structure of government. And so let me then turn a little bit to this sort of question about writing and endurance. Will the constitutions that they write last? If societies are backward looking when they write constitutions, you would expect them to make lots and lots of mistakes, right? Because they're writing constitutions for societies that used to exist and that are perhaps in rapidly changing or in states of flux. And I think that's actually what does happen. I think most constitutions operate in ways, if they do operate in ways that the authors didn't necessarily understand or intend. And constitutional misfirings happen all the time. So when I look forward, what is it that I think that they're likely to get wrong, or what is it? What kind of surprises are they going to pack into the text in these cases? I know Tunisia much less well, so I'm not going to speculate there. But Egypt, I'm convinced that what is happening right now is the constitutional surprise they will wake up to in future years is precisely because they are backward-looking, what various institutions of the Egyptian state are attempting to do right now is to say our problem was precisely what you quoted me as saying, all lines of authority run to the presidency. So what we need, whether it's in the state-owned press, whether it's in the universities, the state-run owned universities, whether it's in religious institutions, whether it's in the judiciary, whether it's in the constitutional court, we need independence from the presidency. We need basically to be a self-perpetuating body. And they're going to get a lot of that. And so what you will have, instead of mechanisms of democratic accountability being written into the Constitution, I think in Egypt, where you have some kind of plurality of political forces, you know, for instance, a constitutional court where some people come from as maybe supermajority in parliament, some are presidential appointments, the various kinds of ways the constitutional courts are created, what you may get in Egypt is a constitutional court that is quite literally self-perpetuating. And in fact, the military, in one of its kind of strange moves, actually already amended the law of the Constitutional Court to make it an entirely self-perpetuating body. They will now select their own Chief Justice from their own ranks. And when you think about it, this is a kind of structure that is, you know, most independent banks, most central banks will not have the degree of independence that the Constitutional Court will have if this actually manages to go forward. So I think the Egyptians will be in for some surprise. I don't know about the Tunisians there. There are, I think, some sort of similar dynamics, but I don't feel as qualified to talk about them. Whether that will endure or not, I don't know, or whether this will be essentially a time bomb or a set of time bombs in this text, where the Egyptians wake up you know, 5 years from now and find that they have absolutely no legal or constitutional tools steer these various fairly strong state institutions in a particular direction, and whether the constitutional arrangements become unstuck as a result, I don't know.
Well, thank you, Nathan. But we should now have a break of just under 15 minutes for coffee and refreshments. But before we do that, let's just thank Nathan for his paper.